Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are on the third matter on our oral argument calendar today. And before I will make a few remarks before we commence with the oral argument. But before I do that, I just want to have the case called. So I'll ask the marshal to do that.
Calling A230302. Benda for Common Sense, a Minnesota nonprofit corporation et al. Appellants versus Denise Anderson, Director of Rice County Property and Tax Elections, Respondent, Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon, Respondent.
All right. And one housekeeping matter before we start the argument. I see that we have counsel here, two counsel for respondents. There are two respondents. Do we have an understanding as to division of the oral argument time? And perhaps I just missed that. I apologize.
Yes, we do.
Okay. And what is it, please?
I will begin and have 7 minutes, and Mr. Hartshorn will finish that off with 8 minutes.
All right. And so what we will do is show have that reflected in the clock, counsel, and then you just, as you know, of course, you're going to watch the clock that's visible on the screen. So thank you for explaining that to me. So let me just say just a very few quick things. We're looking forward to the argument. We're obviously proceeding on the video conference platform Zoom, and so we have this video capability now. The court does maintain an audio recording following the oral argument, and that audio recording is posted on the court's website. And so we ask you at the beginning of your remarks to identify yourself as well as the client that you represent, and then proceed with your remarks. And then the second thing we ask, I've already alluded to, which is that there's a clock visible to you on the screen, and it tends to, you know, go fairly quickly once our conversation begins. So I just encourage you to keep an eye on the clock. With that, we're looking forward to hearing from you. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Matt Benda, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Benda for Common Sense and Kathleen Hagen. The United States Supreme Court and our own Minnesota Supreme Court have long recognized the paramount importance of preserving the orderliness and integrity of the election process. Today, the appellants in this matter implore this court to carefully review and endorse two important mechanisms that have been established by our state legislature that provide transparency and accountability in our election process. First is the Transparency or Sunshine Statute, allowing citizens the right to obtain government data under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. The second important tool under review today is Minnesota's accountability statute, allowing for court scrutiny to correct errors and omissions in the administration of elections, particularly the catch-all provision of Minnesota Statute 204B.44A4. Regardless of whether these statutes are invoked by individuals within the government, those affiliated politically, or simply a lone citizen on a crusade, these tools should be available to impartially allow access to election information and to offer a mechanism to review and correct errors in the process of counting votes. I've watched today and noticed that you don't want me to recite anything. I'm going to jump right into it, and I appreciate the dynamic discussions that are happening. There's a number of complex issues, and I don't know what direction you want to go, so I'm going to start with the MGDPA. And issue one on my appeal brief was our request for an order compelling the disclosure of government data under 13.08 subdivision 4. I submit that under Respondent Anderson's theory of the case, she argues that only one individual in each county in Minnesota is considered a proper defendant in any action to compel compliance with the MGDPA. As their theory goes, if that single individual who is given the title of responsible authority is not or cannot be served in such a lawsuit, then the only possible outcome is outright dismissal. As in our case, since we served with the statute and Rice County clearly designates as the designee under the MGDPA, our case was dismissed by the district court.
So, counsel, I do have a question along those lines, and I appreciate you diving right into the issues. It appears that you argue in your reply brief that Minnesota Statute Section 1303 is plain and unambiguous. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I do believe it is unambiguous. I think 1308 subdivision 4 is the statute in particular. 1303, I believe, is the definition statute. So yes, I do believe there is no ambiguity in the statute. So I'm not arguing we have to go beyond a plain reading of the statute.
Okay, good. That's helpful. And that's a question I'm going to ask opposing counsel as well. So when I look at section 1308, subdivision 4, and you just touched on this in terms of arguing that you could serve a designee as a defendant, I don't see the word designee anywhere in subdivision 4, but I do see references to responsible authority as well as government entity repeatedly throughout section subdivision 4. And even within section 1308, there's repeated references to responsible authority and government entity, but nowhere in that entire section is a reference to designee. So if we're looking at the plain language, how can a designee be served if there's no reference to a designee in that section anywhere?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think everybody acknowledges this statute is complex and confusing, and I'm saying it's plain, and you set me up on that. It is a plain reading. I think it's clear that 1308 subdivision 4 references any duty under the chapter. And I do read that any duty to apply to the designee. And I think, again, when you look at the duty to, and I'm looking for it here in my notes, the duty of the designee, bear with me, is to shall provide copies of public data upon request. And so I believe and I submit that Defendant Anderson is arguing that the designee has no role other than as an assistant. And so our argument is that obligation, which says the designee shall provide copies of public data upon request, makes it clear that that duty is implied and applies to the designee. I note that the legislature didn't say that the designee shall assist in providing data upon request. It gives that specific duty. So I believe that duty applies.
But the duty, doesn't that fall under section 1303 in terms of providing the data? I mean, 1308 talks about the civil remedies and the various civil remedies that are available to a party who wants to obtain that data. Those are two different and distinct sections there, aren't they? And actions.
Well, subdivision 4, Your Honor, is for enforcing any duty under the chapter. We're arguing that the duty applies to the designee, and therefore, that's why we're trying to enforce subdivision 4. You know, the district court and appellant or respondents in this matter argued that because of the language in subdivision 1, that subdivision 4 shouldn't allow for the designee to be a defendant. And I just, you know, again, it doesn't make sense. Why would the legislature go through the trouble of creating a framework to create a designee, allow the counties to put on all of their forms that this designee is the person you're supposed to communicate with, that person is in charge with maintaining the systems, in this case, under the election systems, and allowing the maintenance of those systems? What other role does the designee have? It just doesn't, the legislative intent doesn't translate of why they would go through all that trouble, Rice County.
Right, but under section 1303, subdivision 1B, it says a responsible authority may designate one or more designees. The responsible authority could be the person who's actually taking those actions. It doesn't have to be a designee. It's permissive in terms of that. But I want to touch on something you anticipated where I'm going in terms of section 1308, subdivision 1. And it appears that you argue that we should not look to subdivision 1 when interpreting subdivision 4 because they're mutually exclusive remedies. But I note that subdivision 1 refers to that an action for damages against a responsible authority or government entity which violates any provision of this chapter, and that would include subdivision 4 for failure to compel. So it seems like one condition precedent for an action for damages would be to show that somebody failed to produce documents. And then I also note that subdivision 4 explicitly says that an action to compel can be brought in addition to the remedies provided in subdivisions 1 to 3. So it seems like those subdivisions not only have to be read in conjunction with each other, but they actually explicitly reference each other. So why can't we look to subdivision 1 to make sure that they are consistent? And each one of these subdivisions refers to a responsible authority or government entity and never mentions anything about a designee being a party.
Your Honor, thank you for that question. You're getting right to the heart of it. As an attorney, I certainly was reassured in the strength of my decision to serve the designee, which, by the way, is clearly designated by Rice County. That's one of the parties that's supposed to be responsible and who you're supposed to address things to. I was reassured when I discovered the 2002 Supreme Court case of Weigel versus City of St. Paul, where they talk about the idea that each subdivision does carry its own individual cause of action. And I was further elated when I found this 1982 William Mitchell Law Review article that gave us this concept of legal terminology of a variety of remedies. I use the term, you know, menu of remedies, and the subdivision 4 remedy on its own, again, states any duty under this chapter. The confusing nature of this throughout the statute, they reference designee, responsible authority, government authority. If we truly are going to take that restrictive of an interpretation on subdivision 4, you really are foreclosing an opportunity and causing confusion. I'm not saying I'm an appellate attorney. I'm new at this business, but to say that's not confusing to people out there trying to decide how to proceed and to attain important and fair information, that's a hard interpretation from our perspective.
Right, but it still would be the obligation to serve either the government entity or the responsible authority, whether it's under subdivision 4 or subdivision 2 or subdivision 1, right?
I, Your Honor, I think that, you know, the statute is broad enough that the designee is there. What other purpose does the designee have? And I would point out, again, to concede the point and move on. I don't concede the point. I'm just saying to move on. We did make a motion to add the responsible authority as a party to this lawsuit. Respondents are going to argue our motion was untimely. Regardless, the law says and says if the district court is aware of a necessary party, that party should have been added to this lawsuit. We are asking that the responsible authority be added to the lawsuit, and we just proceed in district court. And I think the district court, you know, avoided that decision and moved on. But we do feel like that is an easy remedy that's available to the court to allow justice to prevail in this case.
Mr. Benner, may I just follow up with one question? Even assuming that the designee could be sued by you for failure to comply with the designee's duty, the duty that's under 13.03 is to provide responses to public requests for public data. But it seems like your complaint asks for a lot more, asks for orders from the district court that would be more related to the responsible authority's role. And it seems to me, why, even if you could bring an action to compel compliance with the designee's duty, why wouldn't that simply be limited to compel disclosure of what you claim to be public data? You ask for a lot more than that. That seems to be more about the responsible authority's role, not the designee's limited role under 13.03.
The majority, the primary request of all of our, the request of both of the co-plaintiffs related to election-related data that was under the control of the designee. And so we, you know, again, the data that's requested is clearly within her purview and under her control as a designee and as, as assigned by Rice County. Your Honors, I have 2 minutes left. If I may, I'd like to move on to the second issue before this court, which relates to the errors in admission statute. And the question of whether the Rice County District Court has jurisdiction to review the usage of modems in Rice County elections. If so, is there expanded usage of modems authorized, and are they part of an election system that require inspection and certification for use in Rice County? The Attorney General throughout this matter has described our legal action as having fatal or foundational flaws. I think it is appropriate inquiry to ask the Attorney General whether the Secretary of State and the Attorney General will present the same passionate arguments and other actions they are or will be parties to. Trying to exclude saying it's too tangential to count votes, that somehow that's not under the jurisdiction of an errors and omissions statute, as certainly would exclude the Secretary from bringing other actions if they're not happy with some action of a rogue county auditor or somebody else that refuses to use election machines. I think that the Attorney General and Secretary of State may want to be cautious about foreclosing the door on other such actions that may relate to this core election duty of counting votes. I have under a minute, Your Honor, so I am going to, you know, again, I think that the issues have been briefed in terms of the modem usage. The Secretary of State has admitted clearly in the record that they've gone beyond the exception of the modem usage. The exception allows them to transmit election data from the precinct to the county. That's the end of that exception. It's clear in the record, Your Honors, that they have gone beyond that exception and they've transmitted election data from Rice County to the Secretary of State's office, exceeding the exception under Minnesota Statute 206.845. Moreover, I fully briefed the issue of the fact that the Secretary of State does not certify modems. They say they don't have to, but it's undisputed that they do not. It's shown clearly in the addendum on page 49 that the certification does not include modems. I've asked the court to do I do think the statute is ambiguous in terms of whether modems are part of an election system. And I think the court is obligated to look at the other authorities out there, which include the report that the Secretary relies upon and the Help America Vote Act and everything that comes with that at the federal level. I see my time's expired. I know I will get my rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors, for hearing me out.
Yeah, thank you, counsel. So we're going to reset the clock. And as I understand it, Ms. Gehring, you're going to begin, and it's 7 minutes. I see that on the clock, so you can begin.
May it please the court. My name is Ann Gehring, and I'm representing respondent Denise Anderson. Ms. Anderson is not subject to suit under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. The statute is clear in multiple places that a political subdivision or government entity can be subject to suit as well as the responsible authority. Ms. Anderson is neither a responsible authority, and clearly she is not a governmental entity. A responsible authority is clearly defined in statute as a political subdivision. It means that they are designated by the governing body. The governing body determines who a responsible authority is. They take a motion, they take action, and give a legal responsibility to the responsible authority. And the duties of a responsible authority are very broad and have a lot of consequences to them.
Ms. Gehring?
Yes.
Who is the responsible authority here? Is it Mr. McCarthy?
Well, there are more than one. I believe there's more than one but Sean McCarthy is currently the responsible authority, the main responsible authority for Rice County. Frequently, there are also other responsible authorities for certain specific departments, but Ms. Anderson is not in any way a responsible authority at all for Rice County. Any department.
So there are multiple responsible authorities for the same, for the county,
right,
as well as designees.
Right.
Okay, let me ask you this. In looking at, the issue comes down to whether an action to compel compliance under subdivision 4 may be brought against a designee who has an obligation, as we know under the statute, to respond to requests for public data. And my question is, when you look at the beginning of that subdivision, it says actions to compel compliance may be brought either under this subdivision or section 1380.085, which is an administrative complaint procedure. I understand that subdivision 4 goes on to talk about like the penalties available against the government entity, the attorney's fees with respect to the responsible authority, but I'm trying to figure out why subdivision 4 tells us that an action against the designee is precluded, especially when you look at 13.085, and it's not even clear there who the respondent is, and clearly the respondent can be someone other than the responsible authority because it says that the responsible authority will be informed if it's not the respondent. It also talks about government entities. I don't know, it's not that clear to me, I guess, or tell me why it is clear that at least an action to compel compliance with a designee's obligation to respond to public data requests can't be brought.
Well, because a political subdivision is a legal entity, they have the ability to put a legal responsibility on the responsible authority. The political subdivision has not made a decision to put on any legal liability on an employee. That is, the responsible authority can be a department head, another employee that the governing body has taken action to designate that person, to put the liability onto a specific person by board action. Now, once that responsible authority has said, I have an employee in my department, I have this employee who I'm going to give some duties to. This person is going to comply. And the statute specifically says a certain category of data, receive and comply with requests in charge of some individual files. These individual files, this person is going to be responsible for receiving requests and complying with some individual files. That the County Board of Commissioners didn't make that decision. They didn't put liability onto that particular employee.
And that this person, Ms. Anderson, was a designee. Is that correct?
Right, but the designee is made by the responsible authority, not by the county board. The county board, the responsible authority is determined by the governing board, not the responsible authority.
I understand that, but the designee had a duty. Let's just say a designee has a duty that's assigned, you say, by the board.
Not by the board.
The
responsible authority.
By the responsible authority.
One employee is giving some duties to another employee.
Right. And so there's a designee. The responsible authority makes this person a designee. Presumably, right. The authority that they give the designee is within the scope of the Data Practices Act. Are you saying that that person did not have authority?
No, they have
the designee. I'm sorry. Are you saying that the designee here did not have authority by virtue from the responsible authority to respond to requests for public data?
They did, but there is distinction here is nothing in the Data Practices Act gives the responsible authority the ability to pass off their liability onto a designee.
Right. I'm not talking about liability, really. I'm talking about just simply subdivision 4 in action to compel compliance. If a responsible authority gives a designee the responsibility of responding to requests for public data, why isn't that narrow? And just tell me why it's a plain language read. Why is the plain language of subdivision 4 tells us that that person may not be subject to an action to compel compliance?
Because the designee is not listed there. Nowhere in that subdivision, the designee is not listed anywhere in there as being subject to suit or action to compel compliance. But the political subdivision is absolutely subject to suit, and so is the responsible authority. And also under other statutes, there's an entire statute under which the responsible authority has numerous duties, which are with response, including creating policies and procedures and regarding compliance. They are responsible for creating and administering the policies and procedures for compliance with the Data Practices Act. And a designee has no such responsibilities. They're not listed there. There is no common law obligation. So an employee has nowhere in the Data Practices Act or the rules regarding the Data Practices Act, does a designee have any obligation to respond to data other than the limited information that the responsible authority has. Nothing in the Data Practices Act does it say that under the responsible authority or the designee provision, that's the only place it exists, can the responsible authority say, and you can be subject to legal action. It doesn't exist in the statute. I'm out of time.
Yeah, and are there any other questions from the panel? Ms. Gary, okay. So we're going to reset the clock. And Mr. Hartshorn, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Nathan Hartshorn, here representing Secretary of State Simon. As Your Honors are aware, we've identified five independent reasons why the court should affirm the district court's decision. Those are waiver, mootness, the limits of statutory jurisdiction, latches, and the merits of the petition or lack thereof. Because of the shortness of time, we'll have to stand on our brief on at least three or four of those. But the issue that I really want to touch on, because it's at the core of the district court's decision, and it's a big part of why the secretary intervened in this case to begin with, is the statutory restrictions on court jurisdiction under MnSTAT 204B44. Now, that's an issue that some very novel, some somewhat surprising things come up in the reply brief that appellants have filed. Now, they are brand new to the reply brief, brand new in this case, that's the waiver problem, but really brand new in Minnesota jurisprudence in general, because the argument that that appellants are making in that reply brief, their construction of 204B44, is just an entirely new way of reading that statute. That posits that, okay, fine, there is this ballot error petition thing that you can do under 204B44, and it has certain restrictions about service and going to a particular election and only district court under certain circumstances. But there's also this entirely different parallel track where you can use 204B44 to file challenges to election procedures in general. The problem with that theory, other than the fact that it was never even hinted at in the principal brief, the problem with that is that it is utterly contrary and utterly destroyed by 15 years worth of binding precedent from the Minnesota Supreme Court. And we've cited that precedent, at least three of those cases, there are at least two or three more. And we've quoted it and we've explained that, and the appellants have simply ignored it. The central decision that I would commend the court's attention to in this area is the 2009 order from the Supreme Court in Minnesota Majority versus Ritchie. One reason why that is absolutely notable in this case is that the procedural posture of that one was so similar to this one, especially once you've read the reply brief from the appellants here. One notable parallel between that case in this case is that in that case, you had the petitioners who were saying that their claims, which had to do with registration information, their claims, they said, oh, they don't just apply to the 2008 election, which had ended. They also apply to the 2010 and 2012 and 2014. And the Minnesota Majority Court said, okay, then you lose, because 204B44 can't be used that way. It can't be used in a way that's not directed at a specific election. The most important sentence in the decision is the plain language of the statute requires that the claim relate to a duty concerning a specific election. Now, in our brief, we presumed, well, obviously the appellants here are going to try to obey that holding, that binding holding the Supreme Court. But no, the reply brief shows that they are making exactly the same argument that the petitioners in Minnesota Majority are doing. They're saying, no, this claim doesn't just apply to the 2022 election. And they're making that argument to try to get out of their mootness problem. But their claim is, no, this doesn't just apply to 2022. It applies to 2024 and 2026 and 28. Well, then, in precisely the terms that the Supreme Court ruled in Minnesota Majority in 09, that means they lose. That means their claim falls outside of the restrictions of 204B44. And that's because of the restrictions that the statute itself provides, but that have been interpreted and applied in decisions dismissing 204B44 petitions in Minnesota Majority and in Clark versus Palenti a year earlier and Began versus Ritchie and some others. The holding in Clark versus Palenti was, quote, that section 204B44 provides, quote, a remedial process only for correction of the ballot and directly related election procedures, unquote. That's precisely to the contrary of what appellants are arguing in the reply brief. And then again, you've got Minnesota Majority. The plain language of the statute requires that the claim relate to a duty concerning a specific election. So this second track that appellants argue that 204B44 permits is illusory. It does not exist. And binding precedent from the Minnesota Supreme Court for 15 years says that it doesn't exist. And because of that, That particular problem that they're trying to state a claim about election procedures in general, rather than something specific to a ballot or very directly related to a ballot, that problem is only one of three problems that they have for statutory jurisdiction. The second one has to do with service. The appellants in this case did not serve a single candidate that was on the Rice County ballot. That is an explicit statutory prerequisite. And in the Supreme Court, when you file these petitions in the Supreme Court, they don't even read your brief until you have filed proof of service on the candidates for the race that you are challenging. That was demonstrated as recently as yesterday afternoon. There's a very famous 204B44 petition going on right now to try to pull a certain candidate off the Republican presidential ballot in March. And in the scheduling order that the Supreme Court issued yesterday afternoon, they require the petitioners in that case to serve former President Donald Trump. And if they don't, that case is over. They have until noon today to do that. That service of candidates is a jurisdictional prerequisite. And if you don't meet it, your case is over. In this case, the petitioners didn't serve a single candidate.
And just to be clear, are you arguing, when you talk about jurisdictional, because there are different types of jurisdiction, mm-hmm. are you talking about subject matter jurisdiction?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. It's not personal jurisdiction or something else, but it's subject matter jurisdiction limitations provided by the statute. So you could call it both subject matter and statutory jurisdiction. And then the third jurisdictional problem here is that 204B44, after it says you have to have a case that involves a specific election, then it says which court you can file that in depends upon which election you're challenging. If it's a state election, which could be the governor, it could be a legislator, it could be a judge. If it's a state election, that petition has to be filed in the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. If it's county, municipal, or school district, then it can be filed in the district court. This petition impacted every election on the entire ballot, which of course included more than 30 state elections. And nonetheless, the appellants filed this in the district court, which is directly contrary to the text of the statute. So for those reasons, that's why the district court dismissed this for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. That decision was correct, and it should be affirmed. I did want to go to, I don't have time to address the problems with the merits, which is the other reason the secretary intervened here. I don't have time to address them at any length, but I did want to address two comments that Mr. Benda made in his oral argument. He says that that there's some kind of concession of quote unquote expanded usage of modems. That's not true. There's nothing expanded about the use of modems in this case. The only usage of the modems is a usage that is specifically authorized by 206.845 subdivision 2, which explicitly authorizes polling place workers to use modems to transmit unofficial results to a central county location. Now, what he means by expanded is that the data then goes from the central location to somewhere else, to the Secretary of State. That's not barred by 206.845. In fact, it's permitted and required by other parts of Minnesota law. I can explain that if you'd like, but I see that I'm out of time or very close to out of time. So I would just say that the Secretary of State would request that the court affirm the district court's decision dismissing this petition for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And if the court doesn't have any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. Does the panel have anything for respondents?
Yeah, it's just one question. So just in response to what you were just saying, is the Secretary of State the central location to which it's sent, or is it not the central location? We got a little off there.
Okay, the specific central location referred to in MnSTAT 206.845 sub 2 is a county's central location. So in that sense, there are 87 of them. But then, I mean, if you want to look up the specific Minnesota law that goes to this, it's Minnesota Rule 8230.3950. That requires information to be transmitted from the central county locations to the Secretary of State, who is a central location in another sense, but not in the formal statutory or rule sense.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you, Judge Bradley.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what we're going to do, Mr. Benda, we're going to reset the clock to 5 minutes, and then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. Yep, and there it is. So you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Smith, I would ask that you read the transcript from October 26, 2022, pages 40 and 41, where this process is described, the difference between the authorized usage of transmission to the county, and then the unofficial elements of what election officials do as described by Mr. Hartshorn. So I just direct the court to that particular transcript to further see the basis of our claim that they've exceeded the exception and they violated the modem ban. Thank you. As I was preparing for today's oral argument, one particular U.S. Supreme Court case I cited really jumped out at me. It was the 1992 case of Burson versus Freeman, authored by our own beloved Minnesota native, Justice Harry Blackmun. In this case, Justice Blackmun went through the history of how our election system evolved from the showing of hands to an ad hoc system of paper ballots and eventually to a uniform secret ballot. In describing this evolution of the ballot process, Justice Blackmun articulated what he called a persistent battle against two evils, voter intimidation and election fraud. What we are now witnessing in today's modern world version of this evolution of the ballot box is the widespread and arguably universal use of electronic ballot boxes. This means we no longer have individuals opening the ballot box and counting the votes. Instead, machines are now used to receive, count, compile, transmit, and report our elections. Nothing wrong with that other than we have to recognize that is a new evolution of how we count votes in our country. Close to my heart, Justice Blackmun talks about the common sense conclusion that there is a direct link between ballot secrecy and a restricted zone surrounding the voting area. Hear, hear. That's what we're looking for, is to protect the secrecy of the ballot. In our new world of machine counting of votes, we must continue to find ways to preserve the sanctity of the ballot and the election process. The public is repeatedly told that these electronic voting machines are safe, secure, and foolproof. Yet any attempt by the public to test this hypothesis with this type of process, meaning appellate jurisdictional arguments, aggressive lawyering, and some level of jawboning, it's hard to test the hypothesis that these machines are doing what they're supposed to do in the new world. I fully recognize and acknowledge the path of least resistance would be to affirm the district court's dismissal based upon the litany of items mentioned by Mr. Hartshorn. But such an outcome, however, will not eliminate the public's justifiable demand that our election process be transparent and subject to accountability. As a state, we must find a way to have our process of checks and balance evolve as election technology evolves. What we are seeing today, and I didn't have time to directly respond to some of the jurisdictional arguments, although again, they're fully briefed. The one I find most intriguing is Mr. Hartshorn's argument that since I didn't serve, or I didn't go to the Minnesota Supreme Court because I served federal candidates on the ballot. Well, my argument is there were also local candidates on the ballot. If I had gone to the Supreme Court, Mr. Hartshorn say, well, the statute says I have to pick district court. That's just an example of how convoluted these arguments are that are being made. Moreover, the idea that there's no precedent for 204B to be used to review election procedures, Mr. Hartshorn is taking a very narrow interpretation of the history of the cases in this matter. I don't think the court needs to go there, needs to follow those. I think there's a clear basis that this is a specific duty concerning an election. Counting votes, it doesn't get any more core into the heart of completing election process than that. Your Honors, I do have to get my ask again. You've seen it clearly in my brief. We are asking for a remand back to district court. Whether it's Denise Anderson or the responsible authority, we have the right to public data and we should have the chance to proceed and pursue that matter. On count three, we are requesting a reversal with a finding that the modem ban has been violated, and separately a determination that modems are part of an election system that requires inspection and certification. Alternatively, I've laid out some remand with factual finding alternatives if the court doesn't feel like the factual record goes beyond defeating summary judgment, which I believe it does. Thank you for your time today. In making your ruling, I would just simply ask you keep in the front of your mind the importance of preserving the orderliness and integrity of the election process. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Our thanks to all of the lawyers in this case. The matter is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.